You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
We're back to talk about entrepreneurship in a digital age. Let me just start by introducing the speakers. To my right is Nicole Vanderbilt, who is Vice President of International for the online marketplace Etsy. We've got Callum McGeoch, who is Creative Director of the Youth Marketing Agency, Liberty, and John Steinberg, who is External Relations Manager for Google EMEA. So, you know, very esteemed panel to look at these issues as we proceed through the day. Now, we know that the internet, the digital environment, is it's a marketplace, it's a knowledge source, it's a sector in its own right, a supply chain, you meet people there. It'd be interesting to explore, perhaps as we go through this discussion, is it something more? Is there something in the nature of the digital environment, a lifestyle, or even a way of mind that is very conducive to entrepreneurial activity, setting up, starting up? Over to Nicole.
Great. Thank you for having me here this morning. It's really exciting to be in this beautiful room on such a cold winter day. So I thought I would just start by giving you a little bit of a background on Etsy, but first I'll ask, how many people have heard of Etsy? Oh, pretty good audience. How many people have bought something on Etsy? Even better. And sold something on Etsy? Okay, a couple of you. Excellent. Excellent. That's always good. So Etsy's mission is to reimagine commerce in ways that make for a more fulfilling and lasting world. The way that manifests itself today is we are the world's largest marketplace for handmade and vintage goods. So you can go onto Etsy and buy everything from a hand-knitted hat to your engagement ring through to brownies and artwork, just so long as a person is actually involved in the creation and making of it. What that means, I think, with the lens of self-employment on, is that we are a platform for people to both build and buy from independent creative businesses. We have over 1 million sellers on the platform globally. Over 90% of them are women, and 2/3 of them are under the age of 45. So a very kind of specific type of entrepreneur that we've tapped into in some ways, although you do find the range of sellers on Etsy are everything from hobbyists who have literally one hand-knitted hat for sale through to professionally trained artists that use the platform to supplement and to really drive a lot of their career. One of the things that I think you hear pretty commonly about entrepreneurs on the internet or in the digital age is that part of what's driving this is the lower need or no need for funding in some cases to get going. And that's very true of Etsy. So we find that almost half of our sellers get started with just their own savings. Another 40% of them say that they didn't really need any funding at all to get started. You know, it's literally 20 US cents to list an item, and then we take 3.5% when it sells. So very, very little needed up front, and you can sell literally one thing, so it's not an inventory or capital-intensive business. And so, like I said, I think you hear that fairly typically about internet businesses, but what I thought I would spend just a few moments on is what I think makes Etsy perhaps distinctive in a way, and what is sort of what we see as a marker of a new type of entrepreneurialism that's happening on our website. One thing is that quite a few of them are part-time, so people are not doing this in many cases full-time, and that part-time choice is driven sometimes because they are carers for dependents of some description. In some cases, they are in full-time work, and they do this part-time as to fulfill other needs. And then in some cases, what we're seeing is a real rise of portfolio self-employed people who are partly an Etsy shop owner, partly a blogger, partly a stylist, partly, you name it. I see a couple of smiles in the audience. Like, there are definitely a lot of people who fit that profile. And so this isn't necessarily an all-in endeavor. The second thing is that they're not entirely growth-focused or entirely, like, rigorously commercially focused. So we actually find that people are looking for primarily freedom and flexibility and meaning in their work. And, in fact, I will often talk to successful Etsy sellers that at times bemoan the success of some of their products, believe it or not, because what it can often mean is that they get focused on making the same thing over and over again, and they don't have the time to design and to be more creative and to sort of explore other types of products, which is a very counterintuitive thing to say, to like not be just thrilled that you're selling loads and loads and loads of one thing. So it's not as much of a hits business. And then lastly, the reason that I get up every morning and get excited to go work on and with Etsy is that it is a very collaborative and supportive set of entrepreneurs. So almost 50% of our sellers have recommended another seller's work. You know, again, a slightly counterintuitive thing. You think of people, small businesses being very and primarily competitive. We don't find that necessarily to be the case. And they're also very supportive. So over a third of them have sought supplies or other opportunities to work together. And another third of them rely on the emotional support and the community that Etsy provides as a key reason to join the platform. And so I think to answer Anthony's question a little bit, I think that there's something about that connectivity that the internet affords, almost ironically, because obviously it's technology, but the people using it, being able to find like-minded creatives, in our case, is a really key draw to using the technology to become an entrepreneur and self-employed.
Great. Thank you, Nicole. I've got us off to a great start. Callum, freedom, flexibility, meaning, and collaboration. Be interested to hear about that in Liberty's world.
Absolutely. Liberty is a youth specialist marketing communications engagement agency, and we work directly with young people from all walks of life, all backgrounds, from our offices in Brixton and in Cape Town and Joburg, in order to create campaigns, content, communities for clients from government, commercial sector, brands and charities. And in doing so, provide thousands of young people, hundreds each year, with pathways and opportunities, training, many of whom we've seen become part of this enterprise culture and increasingly them wanting to start businesses on their own. And it's been fascinating seeing that over the 10 years or so that I've been at Liberty, as our own little enterprise has grown, and seeing that really quite fundamental shift in a generational cohort's mind state and attitude to life. And I think it was about 9 years ago we were asked by Enterprise UK, sadly no longer exists, charity that was existed to support and encourage youth enterprise, to see what we could do, ideas would come up with to help young people aspire to careers, because at that point their research showed that it was at an all-time low. I think it was below 10% of young people aspired to own a business. And that was, you know, widely accepted as one of the indicators of ill health in the economy. And what we didn't know then, and what Enterprise UK and nobody really could have predicted, was actually that the makings of an enterprise culture were already, the conditions were being set at that point, but nobody knew they were coming. And that was the arrival of digital platforms. I think that was pretty much the same year that YouTube started, and organisations like Etsy and Precursors and all kinds of digital tools and social media, social networking. And at the same time, the conditions for the economic crisis as well were brewing. And as we came out of the economic, well, not came out of it, but after the fallout from the crisis and seeing young people leaving college and or deciding not to go to college, seeing the jobs that were promised to the guys just a little bit older than them, the millennials, if you like, evaporate, and those kind of promises, their attitude, thanks to this new technology, was one of self-empowerment, self-motivation, rather than doom and gloom, which I think it bodes really well for the generation that are coming up now, from sort of 21 and younger, really, we see it the most. And what's interesting is that the way that digital or that technology has fueled this attitudinal shift goes broader than just, I think, enterprise as well. It's actually a mindset that they carry, you know, and it's not evenly distributed by any means yet, and it's, you know, certainly centralised in urban centres and London in particular, but it's certainly mirrored in big cities like Johannesburg, where we're working with young people there, is that it's the knowledge that if they wanted to, they could do something off their own back is quite an empowering thing. And lots of young people that we talk to, they don't self-define themselves as entrepreneurs. necessarily, but everyone's got a hustle on the side. There's a sort of kid wearing a T-shirt in the office the other day saying, even my side hustle's got a side hustle. and it's, as much as anything else, it's about having the sense of purpose and a sense of potential in your life, as it is status or achievement or accruing wealth or anything else. But they have a mindset where if they need to know how to do something, they can Google it. If they need to know how, if they want to market themselves, they can do it. If they want to get something manufactured, if they want to raise funds through Kickstarter or however else, the potential is there. And they know because they've seen kids who are just like them, like Jamal on the Google Chrome ads, or even musicians who've forged careers for themselves, create their own momentum off their own backs. And that's a really infectious, infectious thing. What's interesting now is we're seeing employers come to us and say, instead of saying, how can we support this entrepreneurship, which we've done lots of programs and campaigns over the last few years to do, they're now saying, how can we still attract people to come and work for us? So advising big business on how they can, because we will hit, you know, hit points where this starts to become detrimental to the job market, or detrimental, but in conflict and competition with. And in fact, we have it ourselves, where trying to get good people to join permanently is really hard these days. And so looking at ways that you can encourage entrepreneurship, clever ways of using equity, I think we'll see more partnership working, partnership, you know, John Lewis-style business models, and maybe new forms of freelancing and things like that, and how people can work from home, work flexibly using technology as well in big business. The other thing that was mentioned in the earlier session was how whether we're going to hit capacity in terms of the number of small businesses we need, or startups, or how many niches are left to be filled. I think it's quite interesting if we can find ways to... organisations like Google or Etsy, for example, can use some of their data to show young people who don't necessarily have the ideas or know where the gaps in the market are, but they just want to do something, to help them show where the needs are, and kind of open source some of that material, that knowledge, because that young people tend to repeat models that they've seen on the when it comes to the sort of second tier of entrepreneurships. Which is why we've done projects, in fact, funded by Google, where we took ex-young offenders who'd been doing one style of entrepreneurship very successfully, but got into trouble, showed them other styles and taught them digital skills, and it was phenomenally successful, like 90% success rate. But what was interesting about that is 30%... We thought they'd all want to go and start their own businesses, but actually, at the end of the... It was just a three-month intensive program. A third of them... realised that they could go and get, they should get paid to get trained to do more, i.e. get a job. Some of them realised they need to go back to college if they're going to be successful. And the other third did start businesses and are flying. They just need to be shown examples in many cases.
Great.
Callum, thank you very much. I think you made a very interesting point about this sort of generational and global shift of mindset. And of course, Google has been an ever-present in the digital age, and the growth in entrepreneurship has definitely been sort of coincided with the growth of digital usage and penetration and so on. So it would be good to hear this from the Google angle.
Sure. Thank you. And thank you for having me. So I thought maybe I'd approach the question sort of from two points of view. One is a kind of functional point of view. What is digital doing that enables this kind of activity? And then also try to answer the cultural question, which I think is a different question altogether. So we like to, I'm sure everyone has a general sense of what Google is, but I think what lots of people may not realize is all the different ways that we're enabling and being an engine for people to grow their own business, to acquire skills, to, if you're in a business, to find new markets, to export, to work from home, whatever it might be. Where platforms like Google and Etsy are enabling people to make different kinds of choices. And they're also opening up the world of choices. It's creating more different kinds of choices for people. So one of the things that we know is that this kind of technology is lowering barriers of entry. It's just cheaper, easier than ever before to start a business. And people know that. We did research with Kitty Usher, who was here earlier, from Tooley Street Research, which looked at the impact of the internet and online trading on social mobility. And what we found was that people understood that starting a business online was less risky than it used to be to open a shop. It was less costly. You didn't have to open, pay rent, get a lease, hire staff. You know, there's just fewer upfront costs. So technology is, lowering those barriers to entry. It's creating platforms that enable activity. We're providing tools and services. You know, we talk about helping people understand where market opportunities are. There's a Google tool which allows you to see what people are searching for in aggregate. So if I'm a seller of widgets in the UK and I think my widgets are the best, I can go and look across Europe to see where are they searching for widgets, where is the demand for my kind of widgets, and then target my AdWords campaign into that market, become an exporter, very low cost, very low barrier to entry. And so what is also happening is I think there's a as e-commerce has grown and grown and grown over the last 10 or 15 years, people as consumers are more trustworthy. We don't depend on understanding what a big brand is and who they are and what they stand for and are able to buy from them. So it makes selling on Etsy a lot easier because people are interested in and they understand that everyone can get into this game. You don't have to pop in to that big high street brand to trust that you're getting an item of quality. There are also, I think, things that you don't see that are really helping to lower these barriers to entry. So Amazon Web Services, Google Cloud Platforms, it's allowing you not to have to buy a server, not to have to buy kits. You don't have to sign up to a massive package from an incumbent technology provider. You know, Google tools like Docs and Gmail and whatever it might be, all this stuff, particularly when you're starting out, is free. And it just lowers all those costs. So there's that kind of functional stuff. Then I think there's a cultural thing that's happening, which is people are just having a go. There's more risk-taking. There's more tolerance of risk-taking in society. There's more of a sense that, yes, I too can get involved in this game. Callum mentioned Jamal. Jamal is a great example. Some of you may be familiar with him. He started a channel on YouTube about urban music. He became a producer via YouTube. He attracted talent that way. He's built a business just that way. We ran these Google ads about him. It shows young people there are other alternatives. And I think you see that. One of my favorite is the Cambridge Satchel Company, which Julie Dean started. Many of you are nodding your heads. Julie started this company on her kitchen table in Cambridge because she was looking for a way to meet school fees for her girls. She started this business. She starts to grow it using Google AdWords. She becomes a multi-million dollar business. She's featured in Google Ads. She's opened a store in Covent Garden. She's selling in Selfridges and everywhere else. It's the bag to have. She's tied up with big fashion labels across the world now. People see her as an example of what they too can do. So I think that cultural change is just as impactful as the technological change.
Okay, great. Just one very quick question for me before I open out, because I think in all of your contributions, that there's this notion of sort of a hobbying entry point, if you like, that then becomes more economically real and more real in terms of people's lives as time goes on. Should we be worried about the number of people that are making that journey? Should we be trying to promote and encourage more to be making that journey? And if so, how? And what are the support mechanisms that might be needed? Nicole?
I think in a funny way, Etsy's perspective on this, like I said, our sellers aren't so growth obsessed that we will continue to have many hobbyists that actually sort of stay at the hobbyist level. And in some ways, their contribution is well beyond just the number of things they're selling and the amount of sales they rack up, and more the sort of collaboration and support aspects of Etsy. Mm-hmm. We do, of course, a lot of our seller engagement is focused on education. So to try to help, from everything that's very specific to an Etsy seller, like how to take better photography, through to like just good practices as a small business, like how to think about pricing and how to, in this day and age, how to think about keywords and tags and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so we do provide a lot of educational materials to help people on that journey, but we're also quite content with people staying at that stage if that's what suits their their needs, their lifestyle, and what they're looking for.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we haven't yet published it. I hope I'm not revealing something I shouldn't. But we've done a survey which looks at the power to create. And there is a huge group of people who are creative. They have ideas. They're reaching out. They might not have the self-confidence. They want more support. And they feel frustrated because there's something that's not quite there that to support them. You know, is this something that should concern us as businesses, as policymakers, and so on?
So I think it's a really interesting question, particularly for policymakers, because you can look at this argument from a kind of pure economics point of view. So how much are we adding in GVA, GDP, tax revenue, taking people off of benefits? You know, are they increasing employment? And then you can say, well, For some of these hobbyists, that's not happening. So is that a positive outcome or not? I think so, and I think your work, the RSA's work on this, I think is really important because it questions what does a good outcome look like.
Yes.
If the people are happier, if they prefer their work-life balance, if they're more content in their lives, then I see that as a positive thing. But government still has to drive growth in order to pay for government services and in order to meet societal demands. So I think you sort of need a two-track approach. You both want to encourage people to have the lifestyle that makes them most happy. But for people who are focused on 20% year-on-year growth, are the right structures and policies in place to identify those companies, to provide them the support and services they need to do all that kind of work, you know, for the scale-ups. And there was a report last year that I'm sure many of you saw, and a lot of this is, when we talk about money being available for these people, it's really mostly it's about skills. Yeah. It's about business skills and digital skills, particularly business skills. How do you know the challenges that it takes to grow a business 20% year-on-year in terms of both turnover and employees and the management and all of those difficulties? So I think we sort of need to look at that question in two parts.
Yeah, and is that your experience as well?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, we did research into the youth end of these aspiring business and hobbyists for Tech City, who were creating the Digital Business Academy that launched quite recently. And some of the young people we spoke to, it was just about, you know, happiness and work, because they, you know, if they're doing a zero-hour contract job somewhere, and it's for them to have hope in the future, but also just to be able to say, yeah, I'm a photographer, you know, filmmaker, not working in a supermarket or whatever it might be. Mm. And at some point, one might supersede the other. But also, I think there's different types of skills and services that need to be provided to the different types of entrepreneurs. Because I think initially we saw more classic entrepreneurs using technology to be able to start something and find an opportunity and then start it without having to get laughed out of the bank, which is what the, you know, biggest barrier was previously, probably. They could just do something small and didn't need any investment. And if it worked, then great. And then you've got the second wave, which was more who weren't necessarily classic entrepreneurs, but just some people with an idea. Yeah. And they can team up, they could use tools to team up with people, or they, you know, they really need the business skills support, but they've got the nub of an idea. And others who just have real drive and ambition, but don't necessarily have business skills or the ideas, but they can really help move things forward. So I think networking is also another important part of it.
Yeah. Just to build on that, I would say that that to me is an interesting, you made the cultural point of it being more more okay to take greater risks now, and I think that is true. But on Etsy, one of the things that we find really powerful is teams. So sellers actually self-organize into either location-based or sort of interest or topic-based teams. And just having that little bit of extra sort of emotional support and guidance to help you make that leap. You know, you're suddenly, even if you're only selling one thing and it costs you 20 cents to list it, you are taking a big step and putting yourself out in the world and saying, I'm trying to sell this thing. I'm trying to bring something to you. And that part of it, I think, is greatly helped by the peer network that comes out of the digital world in general, and then specifically on Etsy. You can find people who have been through that exact same more subtle process, not just hard skills acquisition, but the leap that it takes to get out there.
Okay,
great, thank you. Okay, I'm going to open it out to the audience now, and we're going to take these in groups of three, and we'll start right here.
I think the opportunities that technology has given for people to develop their own small businesses is fantastic and wonderful. I think it's very interesting that all of you have spoken about the skills that are needed to run a business, and I think that there's a missing element that we're not yet talking about enough, which is about education. One wouldn't be a footballer or a plumber or a doctor or virtually anything in the world without learning something about what one's doing. Whilst the technology provides opportunities for people to start up small businesses, it also creates an illusion that all that one has to do is start up a business and it will be successful.
Okay, can I draw you to a question quickly?
What role do you think the business education has to play in helping people to be make the best use of the opportunities available to
them? Great. Thank you, Adam. And the gentleman in the T-shirt glasses behind.
Werner Kranenberg.
Great, hi.
An attorney. John, when you said trends, do you mean zeitgeist?
No. So there's a zeitgeist is a zeitgeist is a thing that we put out at the end of the year which shows what people have been searching for, so you can sort of reflect on the year past. There's a tool within Google, if you just Google Trends, which allows you to just insert keywords. So if you were a seller of white t-shirts, you could put in white t-shirts, which geographies you care about, and look to see how searches for white t-shirts have changed and trended over the previous whatever time period you want. So you can then figure out, and you can also, if you have an AdWords account, look at that against the cost for advertising against those keywords to figure out there's a huge opportunity in Austria, lots of searches, no one's doing AdWords on that. I'm going to target my AdWords campaign in Austria and become a massive exporter there.
Thank you. It's Michael Parker. Two issues I wanted to challenge the speakers. One on the motivation. We've always had a history of hobbyists in the UK. Some of them, because of the lowering of costs, can convert their hobby into a business. We seem to think, or it's been implied, that this is a new thing. We've had lots of professional hobbyists in the UK. All that's happening, lower costs, enables them to live off that. And we also, I think, need to challenge this concept of risk-taking. When you work as an employee, normally a lot of risks are dumped on the worker rather than the boss. And therefore, jobs are not the same thing with the security that they used to have. Mm. Therefore, becoming self-employed isn't as risky. It may be that you're forced to do that because it's the only thing available to you. So can we change the concept? So I'm challenging the concept of risk-taking and the professional hobbyist.
Great. Thank you. Good. Okay. Well, let's start off with this question of business education. I'm going to start off with Callum. From your experience, is there enough sort of focus on the skills of building a business within the education system or beyond?
I think it works two ways. I think for a lot of, at a kind of school level, I think a lot of young people who do fall through the cracks and aren't engaged in education would benefit from having more teaching of kind of consequential learning in terms of how what they're learning can contribute to them being successful entrepreneurs or successful in the workplace generally, but particularly in entrepreneurship, not just dropping in motivational speakers and stuff like that, but actually baking it into the curriculum so that that keeps them motivated to stay in school as well. But yeah, I think absolutely that when it comes to the point of they are going to actually go into a full business, start a company, there's a huge amount of education and learning that needs to be provided. It's just a question of how you package that up in the right way, because they're not inclined in our kind of what we've seen to necessarily sign up to a course that has a kind of beginning and an end, follows a kind of linear learning journey. They just want to cherry pick, and to get them past that step and then on to the next one, and then when they need to figure something else out, you need to put those learning materials close to the point of need. And that's what I think
Great. John, this point, I mean, to paraphrase Michael, this point about risk shifting, I mean, in essence, what it kind of means, because traditional employment is becoming less attractive, self-employment relatively becomes more attractive. I mean, as sort of economist, do you buy that as a perspective?
So, first, I don't want to overstate my credentials. not an economist, someone who works on economic issues. Important distinction. I mean, I think, first of all, we should look at the RSA's work, right? The trend in self-employment is older than the downturn. So, it's a really interesting point about the shift of risk from the employer-employee relationship and the move away from that kind of job-for-life culture. But we've seen the uptake in self-employment predate this period of economic uncertainty. Certainly, I wouldn't argue that economic uncertainty has driven more people to take that as an option, but I think it's too easy to conflate those two things together. The second thing I would say is that, there are there are kind of legal things that lead people to take more risks. So, you know, we get asked a lot, how do you bring a culture of Silicon Valley to fill in the blank? And one of the things that happens in Silicon Valley is, you know, fail fast. I'm sure you've heard of this kind of language before. And some of it is great, and some of it's kind of Silicon Valley fill in the blank. And but I think what you can look at in different countries is, how long does it take to start a business? How long does it take to close a business? How long does it take to raise money for a business? How long does it take to deal with your debtors? And there are structural things that policymakers could look at which help to change that risk formula. So I think you raised some really interesting challenges. I do think something important has to happen, culture around risk, to get more entrepreneurism happening.
Great, thank you. Now, Nicole, this point, again, to use Michael's second challenge, if you like, that hobbyism isn't something new. It's just more visible now. We're not really seeing a shift in trend. We're just seeing a sort of continuation of old practices by new means. Is that fair, or is there something more effervescent that's happening?
I guess I'll harken back to like a tried internet trope, if you will, that I think is just making for better connections. So these hobbyists, the long tail of hobbying interests, are finding an audience for them in ways that they probably didn't before quite as easily. And I think, just to kind of bounce that back to the risk conversation, in some ways, I think the financial risk it has changed quite a lot, but the risk has gotten a little bit greater with certain types of businesses, because the audience for what you're putting out there, if it is indeed digital, is vast. Mm-hmm. You know, instead of, like, it's different to go to your local village fete and try and sell what you've made. Albeit, of course, you really care about your local community, but to do that and then put it out to like the wider potential buyers on Etsy is a fundamentally different audience. You know, you're going from like your school play potentially to being on TV, and that just has a different emotional risk associated with it, even albeit the financial risks may have shifted.
Great, thank you. Okay, we're going to take a quick fire round of three, so literally just questions, if that's okay. I'm going to take this lady here first.
Hello, my name is Monika Dankl. I just moved here from Austria, being a nature guide and trainer, and I wonder if there is a platform here that sells services. Because products is quite easy to get global, but services is very linked to the person and also the region. I mean, you should reach the people you're training. So any ideas on that?
Okay, thank you.
Hi, Richard Dijkstra. I just wonder, should the focus of government policy be more about people over 50 rather than the young? Because people over 50... you know, are perhaps looking for new careers. They've actually got capital, they've got experience, they've got all sorts of knowledge, and probably want to grow a business which would actually link into employment and things, whereas perhaps the younger people don't have enough skill and expertise at that time, and that actually a better sort of bang for the buck in terms of public policy would be to invest in the over 50s.
Okay, thank you very much. And then the gentleman at the back.
Hi. Dan Hayton, fellow and high technology barrow boy, according to my accountant. One thing that's interesting about the idea of using these things to grow your business, your product, is worry about the intellectual property rights of whatever you have. if you're discussing them on Google Chat or if you're dispensing them to the crowd, cloud rather, what's you know, what are the safeguards that somebody isn't going to get into them?
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, well, let's start off with this question of should there be more focus on the over 50s? And again, in our research, we've picked up a group of very entrepreneurial over 50s who are going to be a key sort of energy source going forward. Do we sort of miss them, and are we mistaken to do so?
You know, speaking again just from Etsy's point of view, we see a pretty wide range of ages on the platform and indeed have many successful sellers that are sort of in the older demographic. I'm not sure if I 100% agree with the premise that they will, or we haven't seen, let me put it this way, we haven't seen in our business a correlation between age and a propensity to scale up a business, which seems to be the sort of implicit assumption. That might be unique to the creatives and the type of work that we do, but I don't think that we necessarily see like scale, a desire for scale or success in pursuing scale correlate with an older seller on Etsy.
John, do you buy this notion that the market is rather underdeveloped on the services front and rather more product focused? And it'd also be interesting if you thought about the intellectual property question as well.
I'm hoping to dodge the intellectual property question because I unfortunately have no expertise to offer you, and so I prefer to say nothing than get it wrong. But I think the services thing is very interesting, and you do see websites like TaskRabbit, I think Amazon has a thing that does micro jobs.
Mechanical Turk? Is
that yes, Mechanical, yeah. So basically websites where you can either post your skills and or as a person looking for work done, post the freelance work you need done. And I haven't seen that developing quite as much in Europe as you hear about it in the US, but on a lot of these kind of technological platforms, you see the US a few years ahead. So I would imagine it will come and grow here. It raises really interesting challenges, I think, in terms of wages and the value of work when you're providing a service, and are we having a race to the bottom? I think those are really interesting challenges for society. You saw a recent report from Biz with Debbie Wasco around the sharing economy and the kind of labor component of that, and I think in that kind of services world, those are challenges that we'll start to discuss and need to face head on over the next couple of years, but there are interesting platforms. The other thing I would just say is in the European context, we need much more. There's a big agenda around the digital single market, and we need a big focus on how digital services are traded across the single market, because that is going to raise real challenges, but also massive opportunities, both for freelancers, for businesses, and for society.
Okay. And Callum, going back to this over 50s question, I mean, obviously you're at the other end of the telescope. You've chosen to go there, but can you see the possibilities at the other side as well?
Yeah, it's not the sort of my world really at work, but it makes a lot of sense to me, absolutely. Maybe there's ways that you can bring young people who know maybe have good knowledge of certain markets or you know the energy and enthusiasm to do certain tasks and take on the collaborating with people who maybe have some capital.
And there's a lot of business knowledge in
that generation,
going back to an earlier question.
Which, let's find ways to kind of share the and also share the digital native knowledge that young people have with some older people who want to do stuff.
I was just going to say, to build on that, I think that's one of the challenges with the business education question is the context in which businesses are operating is changing so quickly. And so the idea that you could have like a linear 12-week thing that would teach you everything that wouldn't be out of date pretty quickly. Similarly, like depending on where and how you've acquired your business education, I think the idea that somebody who brings kind of a youthful and fresh perspective to the changes and yet is and somebody who's grounded in the foundational principles of how, you know, business works and scales is really interesting for that reason, because that, you know, I think that's one of the trickiest things about education, even if we think about it for Etsy, trying to help our sellers get good at being digital sellers is a moving target that is not an easy one to get right. And bringing those different perspectives together feels like a powerful thing.
Maybe another approach is to create a kind of investment market between the two, so they can back and take, you know, a share or equity in already existing early stage startups as well.
Yeah. Okay, great. And the fact about all this stuff is so much of it is spontaneous and it's changing all the time, and people are willing to share and collaborate in whole new ways that we can't sometimes even see. And the question is how you can link people into that sort of spontaneous learning opportunity and environment. Okay, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much to Nicole, John and Callum. I thought it was a very, very informed discussion, brought a lot of issues onto the table. Please, a thank you to our guests and panellists.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.